We can open up to Hebrews. We're going to be in Hebrews 13 tonight, beginning our last chapter in the book of Hebrews. And as we saw last time, the author of Hebrews issued a severe warning to the recipients of this letter, and by extension, Christians. And it was a warning against turning away from the truth, away from following back into the life that they had previously known. But then he also tells them just the tremendous privileges that they have, that all this that they want to turn back to are things that are going to be shaken. They're temporary things. They're created things. They're things that have no eternal and lasting. They have a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and the proper response to that knowledge is to show gratitude, and that gratitude is shown through a proper worship of God. It was an acceptable service with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. In other words, the whole emphasis was that the same God who was this blazing fire and darkness and gloom and whirlwind at Mount Sinai is the same God. He's still, their covenant has changed. The God has not changed. And so they need to respond to what they've received and to worship that is pleasing to Him. And it's this total devotion and commitment to Him, to His Word, and to His will. Well, the author of Hebrews now, chapter 13, is just going to conclude his with a series of imperatives. There's just kind of a rapid-fire series of imperatives and commands that contained in chapter 13. And it really, some people have even said, because there's such an abrupt break in the flow that he just launches into these commands, that chapter 13 is really not part of the original letter, but was added by somebody else later on. But chapter 13 is an integral part of the letter. In fact, it's actually spelling out what it means, what it looks like, to offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. It's showing how we show gratitude, how we show this acceptable service and this worship that is pleasing to God. In other words, he's illustrating here, he's giving imperatives, giving commands for the kind of life that's required of those who are in a new covenant relationship with God. They're no longer the old covenant, they're under the new covenant, which he has been explaining, all the privileges, the better covenant, the better sacrifice, the better priest of Jesus. And because they have all of this, here's how you live. And so it's written to people who have the law of God written on their heart, in which the law of God becomes the intuitive and instinctive rule for their life. And most of the commands that he's giving here, he's given in one shape, form, or another throughout the rest of the epistle earlier on. We also need to understand that the commands that he's given them here, the commands to love of the brethren, showing hospitality, commands about marriage, free from the love of money, then really in verses 1 through 6, he's just giving kind of general principles of Christian life, whereas in verses 7 through 19, he's dealing more with issues of responding to leadership, heresies within the church, and doing good to others. And so when he's giving them these instructions, he's just repeating commands that he's done throughout the rest. But it's also illustrating that this behavior, these commands, where do you do them? Where do you exercise them? They can only take place within the context of the local body, within the local church. And so this is where these things are worked out. So the first imperative, the first command that he gives right there in verse 1, let love of the brethren continue. The brotherly love remain, abide. Meneo is the Greek word. It's to abide, to remain, to continue. This love of the brethren. And the word that's translated love of the brethren is a word we're familiar with, Philadelphia. It's one word in the Greek, from phileo and Adelphos or Delphos, which is brother, or Delphi, which is sister. So it's this let love of the brethren continue. Now what does he mean, love of the brethren? Again, when we start talking about the biblical concept of love, we really need to understand the terminology of love used in the Bible. And because we're too often prone, especially in our culture today, to import our own conception of what love should be and impose that conception on the words in the Bible. But the Bible, the biblical words for love conveyed specific meaning, specific aspects of love. And so it's important to understand the terminology of love that's used in the Bible. And we need to understand that the words that the biblical writers used to convey the concept of love were words that were the normal, everyday words of the culture in which they lived. These were words that were commonplace. They were the words that were used by the culture, by the common people, to convey the concept of love. As we know, there's four Greek words that convey different aspects of love. There's storge, which conveys the idea of, many people have said that it's family love, love between brothers, sisters, parents, children, and so on. And to a certain extent, that's true, but it can't be limited and squeezed into just the little box of just family love. Really, it conveys more the sense of a natural love, even a love that's obligatory. That if you did not love in this way, there would be a serious deficiency in you. And so that's why, of course, what do we think about a parent who doesn't love their child? It's obligatory, that just because of the natural bond that's there. And so, yes, it is a family love. It is a, but it's the basis is more, it's just a natural love. It's natural for somebody to love others in this way. It can be the same thing as a person's love for their country. The same word can be used. It's a natural love, something that would normally be expected. And then the other term, a love that is used, is eros, which often gets misrepresented as, because we get our word erotic from it. It's supposedly dealing with the type of love that's lust. It's immoral. But that's not true. That's not what the word eros conveys. It's primarily conveying an aspect of passion in love. And so this can be in any type of loving relationship. There can be an element of passion. And so eros simply conveys. First two, storge and eros, they're only used, I think eros is only used one time in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. Storge is only used maybe half a dozen times. Neither one is used at all within the New Testament. And that it's not because these ideas or these words didn't work to convey the idea of love that they were trying to convey in the New Testament. It's simply that, as in any other language, some words fall out of vogue. Some words just aren't used anymore. Other words tend to predominate. And so the reason the New Testament doesn't use the word storge or eros is simply because those words were no longer part of the vocabulary of the common everyday people. They just weren't used that much. Rather, the two words that were used, they're used predominantly in the New Testament, is phileo, which just, it's means an affinity. Oftentimes it's been portrayed as a love of friendship. And but that's even too narrow a definition. It's really, it conveys an idea of an affinity, an affection, an emotional attachment. There's a delight, even a mutual delight, a mutual love based on mutual interest and mutual beliefs. There's something pleasing that is found in the object of the love. Agape, which has really been misrepresented as though it's some higher form of love than all the other types of love that the Bible talks about. And agape does not represent a higher, more exalted, elevated form of love. It just simply expresses a different aspect of love. And that aspect of love tends to be more toward, it's an admiration, an esteem, a prizing, a valuing. If you go back and look at some of the classical Greek writings, they'll use the word agape and phileo in relation to a king, that the people of the land not only agape'd their king, but in other words held him in high esteem, but they also phileo'd him. There was an emotional attachment. There was a genuine liking. Probably the best analogy we can have for this in our more modern history would maybe be the affection and the esteem that people had for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, you talk to anybody who grew up during the Depression or went through World War II and who really looked up to Roosevelt. I mean, there was not only this admiration and esteem and valuing of him, but there was a real genuine affection for the person and for the man. And so the agape leans more toward an admiration, esteem, prizing, valuing. The thing is, by the time the Septuagint was written, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, virtually all of these words, storge, eros, those two especially had fallen out of vogue. Even phileo was not used that much. 95% of the time the word love is used is translated in the Greek New Testament is translated with the word agape. And just to illustrate that this word does not always reflect a higher, greater form of love, remember over in 2 Samuel 13, familiar with the story of the incest in David's house. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1. It was after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Well, if we know the story, we know that Amnon did not love Tamar. If there was anything, there was this gross, incestuous lust. As verse 4 says, toward the end of verse 4, Amnon says, I'm in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. Well, and then we all know the history of what happened. And then in verse 15, after he had violated her, then it says, then Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, for the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. Well, nobody would say that this was some great higher form of love, but it's the word agape that the Greek translators used in the Septuagint. Why? Well, it's simply because by the time the Septuagint was written, within the common language of the people, the word agape had been the word, the common word, to express all aspects of love, virtually all aspects of love. And even in the New Testament, phileo is used very rarely. It's only, and even when it is used, a third of the time it's used, it's used in reference to a love of things, food, drink, idols that people made, whatever it is. So the word agape does not necessarily refer to this higher, greater form of love. that's so often represented. It was simply the common word of the people at that time to express virtually all aspects of love. So when another word was used in its place, it's because there was a different aspect of love that was trying to be conveyed. An example of this, John chapter 3, verse 35. And we talked about this when we went through John, but in John chapter 3, verse 35, John the Baptist states, "The Father loves the Son and has given all things into His hands." But then there's a parallel verse over in chapter 5, verse 20, where Jesus Himself says, "For the Father loves the Son and shows Him all things that He Himself is doing." Well, in verse 35 of chapter 3, the word love there is agape. In verse 20, the word love there is phileo. And it's in verse 20 of chapter 5, it's the only time the word phileo is used in speaking of the Father's love of the Son. What's the difference? Well, in verse 35, John the Baptist is, when he says the Father loves the Son and has given all things into His hand, he's talking about a love that the Father has for the Son, in which the Son is highly esteemed, highly regarded, and as a result, He has given all things into His hands. Whereas over in chapter 5, verse 20, when Jesus says the Father loves the Son and shows Him all things that He is doing, He's speaking there about the tender affection that the Father has for the Son. It's this tender, fatherly love and affection. And again, John chapter 5, verse 20 is the only time in the New Testament where the love is expressed, the love that's of the Father to the Son is expressed by any other word other than agape. We see in John chapter 16, verse 27, where Jesus in His farewell discourse tells the disciples, "For the Father Himself loves you because you have loved Me." Well, there, both times, the word love is phileo. It's the only time in the Bible, only place in the Bible, where God is said to phileo mankind. And here specifically, disciples, His children, this tender, loving affection. And it's the only place where phileo is used of the disciples' affection for Jesus. A tender, loving affection for Him. And so, why do I tell you all this? Well, because it helps us understand what the author of Hebrews is saying when he says, "Let love of the brethren continue." It's not agapadelphia, it is philadelphia that he's saying. It's the love, and every time the word Philadelphia is used in the New Testament, it's always used of a love between Christians. It's an affinity. It's an affection, an emotional affection based on a mutual interest and a mutual love. There's a true mutual interest here. And that interest is in Jesus Christ, is in the truth. They're truly been, have a new heart and new desires and new affections. And so it's not just an ooey-gooey sentimentality, lovey-dovey relationship where everybody ignores everybody else's differences. No, this is a true love based on mutual interest, mutual love, and love, true love and affection for Jesus Christ. And that spills out over into a true love and affection for one another. And just to give, again, a little better idea of this, we see in John chapter 15, this is more from a negative aspect. In John 15, 19, Jesus tells the disciples, if you were of the world would love its own. It would phileo its own. See? If you were the world, if you were like the world, there would be this mutual interest between you and the world. There would be a mutual natural attraction. But for you, for the world, and the world for you, because you were attracted and mutually attracted to the same things that the world was attracted to. But because you're not of the world, because you're not attracted to the same things of the world, because you have no affection for the things that the world has an affection for, you have no attachment, no commonality with them, therefore the world hates you. It's the same thing James said in James chapter 4, verse 4. Don't you know that some translations will say, don't you know that friendship with the world is to be an enemy of God? But that word friendship is actually phileo. Again, being translated by some as a love of friendship, but that's too narrow. It's really to be a lover of the world, to be this one who has this mutual attraction, a mutual affinity for the things of the world, you're an enemy of God, because the world and God are at polar opposites. So he says, let love of the brethren continue. Philadelphia, this love of the brethren. Paul, this word is only used four other times in the New Testament. Again, Romans 12, verse 10. Be devoted to one another. That's another. Devoted to one another is another phileo word. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. So here you see this brotherly love has an element of devotion to one another. Why? Because we're all devoted to the same thing. Jesus Christ. You know, we've talked the past couple of Sundays, 1 Thessalonians 4:9, where Paul says, you have no need of anyone to teach you to love one another, Philadelphia, because God Himself teaches you, Philadelphia, to love one another. There's this mutual interest. 1 Peter 1:22. Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere Philadelphia, love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. So see, it's a sincere. 2 Peter 1:7. Again, the last time the word is used in these eight Christian virtues that Peter begins up in verse 4, he gets to verse 7, in your godliness you have brotherly kindness. In your brotherly kindness, love, Philadelphia. So there's this mutual affection, mutual regard, a real affinity for one another. But it's based, again, in the relationship with Christ. And this brotherly love, it's the product of their privileged position as members of God's family. Those who have been brought in to God's family. It's their new covenant relationship. And again, it's not just an emotional attachment. It's a love that expresses itself in real actions. Remember back in Hebrews chapter 6, verse 10, he had told them, for God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown toward His name in having ministered and in still ministering to the saints. See, this is how their brotherly love expressed itself. Was in ministering to the saints. That's essentially what John said over in 1 John chapter 3, 16 and 17. You know, that if Jesus laid down his life for the brethren, we should lay down our lives for one another. And if which one of you, having the world's goods and sees his brother in need and doesn't help him, how's the love of God abide in you? So here it's a real tangible love. It's an attitude. It's actions. And he tells them that this love of the brethren is to continue, to meneo, to remain, to abide, present tense, habitually, continuously, constantly. Because this love of the brethren, this is part of the kingdom that can't be shaken. It's all part of the kingdom that can't be shaken. It's not going away. Remember what Paul said over in 1 Corinthians 13:13? Now abide these three, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest is love. Why is the greatest love? Because love lasts forever. You don't need faith in heaven anymore. You don't need hope in heaven anymore. But love will abide forever. Love will retain forever. It's part of the kingdom that can't be shaken. And so, it's to remain, it's to continue, it's to abide. And it remains and abides by the people in the community, in the Christian community, remaining steadfast, not shrinking back, not turning away. So the first command was, let love of the brethren continue. Philadelphia. And then he gives another command. Not only should love for the brothers and sisters in the community who are in Christ continue, but do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Here's another phileo word, philoxenia. That's what the word hospitality is translated. It literally means love for strangers, love to strangers. So it's not only love for the brethren, but love for strangers. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. It's showing, practicing. So, you know, how many times have you heard people say, oh, they have the gift of hospitality, which means they enjoy having people over to their house for dinner. Well, that's not the hospitality of the Bible. This is showing hospitality to strangers. This is a concrete expression of Christian love. It's not only expression of love, but it's a responsibility of God's people going all the way back into the commands of the Old Testament. If you look in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 34, this is all part of the commands given to the nation of Israel, that the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as of yourself. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So there's this command to be hospitable to strangers. And again, when we understand in the New Testament culture, there were not Holiday Inns set up around everywhere. There weren't Sheraton's hotels that people could go to. Any inns that existed in the Greco-Roman world were particularly pretty grungy, often houses of ill repute. They were not the best places you wanted to be found in. And so oftentimes travelers would seek shelter in private homes. And this was part of the culture of Judaism, was that you took care of strangers. When somebody came to your home seeking shelter, seeking lodging, you sheltered them, you lodged them, you showed hospitality to them. And this was something, you know, in Acts 16, when we see Paul is in Philippi, and he converts Lydia and her household. Lydia has them stay in her house and puts them up and cares for them and feeds them and sends them on their way. In fact, having hospitality was required of leaders. 1 Timothy 3:2, that this is one of the requirements of somebody who's going to be an elder. They have to be hospitable. Titus 1:8. But there were also restrictions placed on this type of hospitality as well. If you remember over in 2 John, you know, 1 John tells us that there's false teachers out there. 2 John tells us stay away from them. 3 John says support true teachers. But 2 John verse 10, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting. For the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. And so there's a sense by lodging and taking care of and showing hospitality to a false teacher, you became a participator with them. You were aiding and abetting them in their false teaching. And you don't want to do that. So don't do that. But then in 3 John verse 5, beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers. And they bear witness to your love before the church, and you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing for the Gentiles. Therefore we ought to support such men, that we may be fellow workers with the truth. See, in supporting true teachers, you become a participant with them. In supporting false teachers, you become a participant with them. You don't want to support false teachers, you want to support true teachers. In fact, there was even a man in the church there when John was writing this letter by the name of Diotrephes, who in verse 10 we are told, that for this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. And not satisfied with this, neither does he himself receive the brethren, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. So Diotrephes was not being hospitable, and he was denying people within the church to be hospitable, or telling them not to be to anybody. He wanted to be the chief muckety-muck, and he didn't want anybody else, any other teacher coming into town. And so he became hostile toward him. And I think this is when it's telling us to show hospitality to strangers, especially as we saw over there in 2 John, where John commends them for showing or rather 3 John commends them for showing hospitality to these itinerant ministers of the gospel, and he said, even some that are strangers. This is primarily what he is referring to, is that you don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers, and the reason, he says, is, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Well, what does he mean, angels? Well, some commentators have said that he could be referring here, or an allusion to Abraham in Genesis 18, when the three messengers, three people came to Abraham. One of them turns out to be the pre-incarnate Jesus. The other two are the angels that eventually go into Sodom and Gomorrah. Could be, you know, referring to events like Lot, who harbored the angels that were sent to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Look over in Judges 13 of Manoah, who's the father of Samson, who entertained and the angel of the Lord and asked the angel of the Lord to stay. But I don't think that it's talking here about literal angels. He says, for by some, because it just doesn't fit the context of this showing hospitality to strangers, especially within the New Testament context of the itinerant preachers coming along and supporting them. I think it's in light more of Jesus' teaching in Matthew 25, where Jesus, speaking of how to treat those who are his brethren, where he speaks of, you know, I was naked and you clothed me, I was hungry and you fed me, I was in prison and you visited me, and asked, well, when did all this happen? When were you thirsty? When were you a stranger? In verse 40, The king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me. So I think that the author of Hebrews is pulling more from this teaching of Jesus more than from an Old Testament analogy. And you say, yeah, well, the word says angels here. Well, it's just the word angelos, and the word angelos can mean messenger as well as a literal angel. In fact, it's translated this way several times within the New Testament. In Matthew 11, verse 10, Jesus, speaking of John the Baptist, says, this is the one about whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before your face, my angelos before your face, who will prepare your way before you. It's also the same passage. It's in Mark chapter 1, verse 2, where it's referring to John the Baptist. Also, in Luke chapter 7, verse 24, it says, and when the messengers of John had left, he began to speak to the multitudes about John. The word messenger is angelos there. So it's these messengers of John. Also in Luke chapter 9, verse 52, where we're told that Jesus sent messengers on ahead of him into Jerusalem. It's the word angelos. These were messengers that were sent ahead. And they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. Also over in James chapter 2, verse 25, it's used of Rahab who received the messengers, angeloses, and that Rahab was saved by faith, by receiving these messengers. So we see there's numerous times where the word angelos can be translated, not angel, but messengers. So what the author of Hebrews is saying that, listen, these strangers that are coming to you that you are to show hospitality to may be true messengers of God. Just like over in 3 John chapter 5, verse 5. They're true messengers of God. And by assisting them, you are assisting the work of God. You're assisting the work of Christ. You are becoming a participant in the work of Christ by doing this. So that's the second command. So you have this love of the brethren, you have the love of the strangers, and he tells them, do not neglect this love. The word neglect is rather forget, forgotten, uncared for. In other words, it's a willful neglect, shirking of the responsibility, like Diotrephes. Don't do that. Don't do that. But rather, show this hospitality to these strangers. Because by doing so, you may be entertaining, supporting true messengers of God. And as such, you will be participating. You will be doing it as unto the Lord. Just as Matthew 25. So not only are they to not neglect, there also, verse 3, there's a positive. Do remember. The prisoners. Literally continue to remember the prisoners. See, this is a characteristic of this church's past behavior. If you remember back in chapter 10, verse 34, for you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. See, they could do this because they're receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. They have an abiding possession. And so this was characteristic of their past behavior, this remembering the prisoners. It involves a real practical care for them. And even an identifying with them and willing to be identified with them. You know, Paul talked about in 2 Timothy during his second Roman imprisonment, 2 Timothy verses 1, or chapter 1, verse 15, Paul wrote, "You are aware of the fact that all who are in Asia turned away from me, among whom are Phygellus, Hermogenes. The Lord grant mercy to the house of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. But when he was in Rome, he eagerly searched for me and found me. And the Lord grant to him to find mercy from the Lord on that day. And you know very well what service he rendered at Ephesus." So here you have Onesiphorus, who is not ashamed to be associated with Paul. He sought him out. He remembered him, offered real practical care to him, which is why the author of Hebrews, you remember the prisoners as though in prison with them. You know, you're right there with them. You care for them the way you would want to be cared for. And not only is it to the prisoners, but he says, and those who are ill-treated. All Christians who are being mistreated, ill-treated, that you're able to help. It's the same word used over in verse 25 of chapter 11. Speaking of Moses, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Also, among the martyrs in chapter 11, verse 37, they were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. See, you remember these people. You remember them. And the reason is, since you yourselves are in the body. Now, some early commentators interpreted this as in the body of Christ, in other words, in the church, but that's not the best interpretation. You're in a body, you should know how it would feel to be afflicted and ill-treated in this way, how it would affect you physically. It's essentially what Paul says over in 1 Corinthians 12:26: if one part suffers, all suffer. You understand this. And so you do what you can to alleviate their suffering. Jesus did this for us, didn't he? This is what the author of Hebrews brought out in the very beginning of the letter. Chapter 2, verse 14. Since then the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil. See, Jesus took on human flesh. He identified with us, with our weaknesses, in order to set us free from the power of death, to redeem us. He shared our circumstances. He's saying, put yourselves in their place. Do all that you can to alleviate their suffering. Well, from there, in verses 4 through 6, he moves into the age-old problems of immorality and money. These age-old moral issues, they're still with us today. 7th and 8th commandments: do not commit adultery, do not steal. Immorality and greed. Let marriage be held in honor among all. Let the marriage bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers God will judge. See, there's just nothing but pure selfishness behind immorality and behind the greed. Verse 5, let your character be free from the love of money. Both immorality and greed are driven, motivated by nothing but pure self-centeredness and selfishness, self-gratification. And we see these two themes linked together throughout the New Testament, throughout the Bible, money and immorality, immorality and money. It's typically in that order, immorality and money. And, you know, you have Jesus talking about you can't serve two masters in Luke 16. And the Pharisees are scoffing at him. Why? Because they're lovers of money. Well, here, first is let marriage be held in honor among all. There's two exhortations there in verse 4. Honor marriage, avoid, refuse sexual sin. The word honor just means highly valued, highly prized. Why? Because it's ordained of God. It's an institution of God. It's divinely ordained union. It's not the product of man. It's not something man in the history of civilization came up with marriage for a stable family environment. No, it's a divinely ordained union. And as such, it is to be held in honor, it is to be protected, it is to be supported, it is to be valued, it is to be preserved. All those have the concept of honor. Boy, that's not the way it is today, is it? Not by a long shot. I mean, marriage has been under assault for decades. For everything from no-fault divorce to what we're seeing today with the redefinition of marriage to just throwing off marriage altogether and saying, let's just shack up and cohabitating, and you have common law, husband and wife. Just the whole valuing and prizing of marriage is not in our society. Today it's mocked. Today it's perverted. It's certainly not highly prized. It's certainly not highly valued. It's just something that's disposable like the rest of society. But he says it's to be held in honor among all, and that the marriage bed be undefiled. In other words, all sexual relationships outside of marriage are profane. And it's to profane what God has made holy. It is to corrupt what God has made holy. It defiles the marriage relationship. It rejects God's perfect plan. It's motivated by self and selfish self-gratification. It's desiring the pleasing of the flesh over the responsibility to God. And as such, all who engage in this will face God's judgment. Because he gives the very reason that marriage is to be held in honor. For fornicators, that's just immoral people, pornos, if fornicators, any immoral people, and adulterers, God will judge. You're under the judgment of God. So all these people running around today thinking that they're just living their life the way they want to live it, that marriage is no big deal, it's something that's optional, that it's just an intrusion into the pursuit of a career, and let's get a career established before we get married, and then you have your life and I'll have mine, and it's all just a marriage of mutual convenience. And if it doesn't work out, hey, we can throw it away and start over again. Or this total redefinition of marriage where it's between, you know, two men, two women, whatever, all of that, that comes under God's only expression is within marriage. And marriage, by definition, is between one man and one woman. All else faces God's judgment. Isn't this what Paul said, 1 Corinthians 6:9? And the whole litany of those who will not see the kingdom of God, fornicators or adulterers, they will, homosexuals, all the whole list, they will not see the kingdom of God. Never. In fact, in Revelation, we see the new heaven and the new earth, the eternal state. We're told in Revelation 22:15. Revelation 22:15. That outside, that is outside, are the outside the New Jerusalem are the dogs, the sorcerers, the immoral persons, the murderers, the idolaters, and everyone who loves and practices lying. See, these are never in the eternal state. It's an eternal separation under the judgment and wrath of God. Well, it's a big issue in the Greco-Roman world, and the Jewish culture still is today. Let your character be free from the love of money. Here's another phileo word. Only this is philarguros. Has the alpha privative on the front, meaning a negation. Philarguros is love of money. Philarguros is not the love of money. Let your character be free from the love of money. Remember Luke 16:14. The Pharisees are described as lovers of money. They were philarguros. They had an affinity. There's an attraction. There's a delight in money. That's not the character. That's not the way of life. That's not the manner of life that's supposed to be part of a Christian. The love of money and the trust of God are incompatible. They don't go together. You can't have them. I tell you, if there's anything that has infected the church today and that dominates most of the professing church today, it is a love of money. I mean, it's real obvious which master the church today has decided to serve, at least the vast majority of it. Walk into any, virtually any so-called Christian bookstore and see what's up front. Is it about the promotion of truth, or is it about what sells? It's all about generating revenue. It's not about promoting truth. If it was about promoting truth, they couldn't sell 85 to 90% of the stuff that is on their shelves. So much the grossest heresy that's out there. We have so-called Christian consumerism. Now, we have groups out there, Christian consumer advocacy groups, telling us what products to buy and what products not to buy. Christian today has become nothing but a demographic in which to market Christian products. You know, you slap a cross or a fish symbol on it, it's Christian. And then the church growth today is nothing but revenue driven. It's purely revenue driven. Denominations are very territorial. Not because they're afraid someone in their flock is going to stray and become exposed to a heresy in another denomination. It's no, because if they leave, they take their checkbook with them. And it's all about keeping everything with under our own roof so we can keep the money there. It's all driven. This has become a manner, a way of life that dominates so much of the church today. It's dominated by love, by care, by concern, by desire for money. This is what Paul told Timothy. Flee from these things, you man of God. It's this accumulation of wealth. Because wealth means power. Hey, the more wealth you have, the more power you can exert. That's not what he tells them. He says, be content with what you have. Let your character be free from the love of money. Don't have an affinity for it. Don't have an attraction to it. As Proverbs tells us, as soon as you set your heart on it, it takes wings and it's gone. Don't let this become the pursuit. But yet it is. But instead you're to be content. Being content with what you have. This is Paul's attitude over in Philippians chapter 4, remember? And it was something he had to learn. He said he had to learn. Where he says, not that I speak from want. In other words, the Philippians had just brought a wonderful gift to him while he's under house arrest in Rome to meet his personal needs. He says, not that I speak from want, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. And then that most misused verses of all out there, or one of them, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. I can be content in whatever circumstance I'm in because of Him who strengthens me. Because my contentment is found in Him, in Christ. Not in anything else. You know, our society, our economy fosters discontentment. The whole economy is driven by discontentment. Bigger, better, more. Just doing a little research. Home sizes have more than doubled since the 1950s. Average home size is more than doubled since the 1950s, but yet families have gotten smaller. It's not just that people have, everybody in the house has their own television now, everybody in the house has their own bathroom. You know, heaven forbid that two or three siblings should have to share a room together. Everybody's got to have their own bedroom. You know, there's just this, you don't like your looks, we'll go to a plastic surgeon. You know, they can fix that. You don't like the way God made you, we can change that. Not content with your spouse, go get another one. See, this, we live in such an uncontent society, and our culture today, and not just today, but throughout history, the idea of contentment is I can be content if I get what I want. And that's just not contentment. There's a great little book by Puritan Jeremiah Burroughs, The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. And he identifies or defines Christian contentment this way. He says, Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. So you're not only freely submitting to, but actually delighting in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Because you know it's what's God's best for you at the time. Because you're in the hands of a good and loving sovereign God who only brings about our best. He makes this statement. It says, a Christian comes to contentment not so much by way of addition, but by way of subtraction. What does he mean by that? He means that you don't get to contentment by adding to your life, by getting the things you want, rather you bring your desires down to what you already possess. I don't want more than what I already have. I desire nothing else. It says the psalmist said, Asaph said, I desire nothing on earth but you. Psalm 73. It's just being content. Being content, it's not an irresponsible carelessness that where it's this, you know, hey, I'm living in a shack with a hole in the roof and rain's coming in and my children are starving, but I'm content. No, that's not contentment. Contentment is just a trust in the promises of God and knowing that whatever circumstance we're in, it's the best for us at the time. And trusting God in those circumstances. And he even gives us, the author of Hebrews gives us the reason for being content with what you have. And he's telling this to a group of Christians who are undergoing serious persecution or about to undergo serious persecution. And he's telling them, be content. You've already joyfully undergone the seizure of your property. You know, we're talking to people here whose livelihoods have vanished, whose have been turned against by people they care about. But you can be content with what you have, for because he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. See, it's because of God's solemn promise. Jesus reiterated this in Matthew chapter 6. Why do you go after everything the Gentiles go after? Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. Then all these other things will be added to you. Your Father knows you need these things. So don't worry about it. It's just this passage that he quotes, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. That particular passage doesn't have any correspondence in any particular New Testament passage, but it does reflect many sayings within the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 31, verse 6 through 8. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He shall not fail you or forsake you. He told Joshua, be strong and courageous, for I am with you. What did Jesus say in the so-called Great Commission? That he's to go and make disciples, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. God never abandons His people. There's a promise of His continued presence, protection, and provision. So, here's the reason you can be content. Because you're always in God's hands. The circumstances that you're in are the circumstances that are best for us at the time. And we can trust God in those circumstances. And then he concludes in verse 6, so that, you know, in light of this fact that we have God's promise, we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid, what shall man do to me? He's quoting Psalm 118, verse 6. It's essentially what Paul says in Romans 8:31 as well. God is for us, who can be against us? See, we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. See, when you have a fear of God, you're not going to be afraid of anything else. Fear of God eliminates fear of man. This fear of God, this awe, this reverence that is spoken of up in verse 28, chapter 11, that awe, that reverence, that holy fear excludes all other fear. Because it's a reverence, it's a trust in the promises of God. See, this is how God demands to be worshipped. It's this absolute trust and reliance for all. It's obedience in all respects. Without wavering, without hedging. It's not this, well, yeah, I'll do this for you, God, when all the circumstances line up in a row, when all the ducks are in a row, when I got enough money in the bank where I don't have to worry about anything, then I can trust you and then we can do all this. No. It's now. See, we serve the same God. We have the same promises. We have the same commands, the same requirements of us. And if we're to worship God and worship, that's an acceptable service with reverence and all, this is what we do. These are the commands. These are the injunctions. Love the brethren. Love the strangers. holding marriage in honor, free from the love of money, and an unqualified trust in God. Heavy.